Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. State officials say they're pleased with the initial rollout of recreational marijuana sales in Delaware.
It was a strong first month, hoping to capitalize on the momentum and keep pushing forward as we look to bring new licensees online as well.
The latest edition of our High Hope series examines how things are going and what's next. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about efforts at the University of Delaware to find a more effective approach to puberty education and why Reading Assist is being recognized for its work. Plus, Arts Playlist previews the remaining shows this season at Rehoboth's Clear Space Theater. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware launched its first wave of recreational marijuana dispensaries on August 1st, giving the majority of existing medical marijuana centers the ability to begin recreational sales. As of Monday, the Office of the Marijuana Commissioner has issued 85 conditional licenses for the rest of the marijuana business community, with three cultivators already actively growing. In part three of our Delaware's High Hopes series, Marijuana Commissioner Josh Sanderlin talks about his optimism for the remaining market launch, as well as the contentious veto of a marijuana zoning bill. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich also checked back in with license holders to discuss the challenges and successes they've seen in getting their businesses off the ground, and what's next for Delaware's recreational marijuana market.
Medical marijuana dispensaries, which purchased a conversion license, were given the green light to begin recreational sales just over a month ago. And Delaware's Marijuana Commissioner Josh Sanderlin says things are going smoother than anticipated.
I was, having been in the industry for over a decade, was fully prepared for bumps in the road, and everything seemed to go pretty well.
Sanderlin says Delaware had its highest month in marijuana sales ever in August, almost doubling the state's previous highest with $7.3 million in sales.
It was a strong first month, hoping to, capitalize on the momentum and keep pushing forward as we look to bring new licensees online as well.
While medical dispensaries' recreational sales are in full swing, it could still be some time before Delaware consumers can enter independent recreational stores. In 2024, the Office of the Marijuana Commissioner awarded just under 125 marijuana licenses to hopeful individuals, which included licenses for cultivators, manufacturing and testing facilities, and retail dispensaries. Getting these individuals their conditional licenses, which would allow them to begin engaging in business activities like growing product, purchasing real estate space, and partnering with investors, has faced several hiccups over the past several months. The state legislature had to pass two bills this year to ensure license holders could receive a federal background check, and county zoning decisions and municipality bans on marijuana dispensaries have caused their own rifts within the industry, particularly in Sussex County. Sussex County opted to allow marijuana retail stores to land on parcels zoned as C3 heavy commercial and also implemented a 3-mile buffer zone between dispensaries and sensitive locations such as schools and parks. These combined ordinances, along with all but two municipalities banning dispensaries, have created a de facto ban on marijuana business in the county, leaving the 10 Sussex County license holders at a loss for viable retail space. These concerns prompted the legislature to introduce Senate Bill 75, which would limit countywide buffer zones to just 500 feet. But this sparked debate over if state lawmakers should be intervening in decisions made by local governments, a recurring theme during Delaware's legislative session this year. Senate Bill 75 did ultimately pass in June, but Governor Matt Meyer opted to veto the legislation in August, citing concerns of overriding local control. Governor Meyer also attached draft legislation to his veto statement that would give counties 4.5% of the total revenue brought into the state via its 15% tax. Currently, counties and municipalities do not collect any revenue from marijuana sales.
It's a tough balance to strike, right? So we want to, make it easy for businesses, but also we want to allow local governments who have the responsibility of, providing the local regulations, the local ordinances, the local control over it, bring them on board and not force the way through.
The sponsors of Senate Bill 75 argue liquor stores do not share in alcohol sale revenue, but Sanderlin says it isn't uncommon in other states to grant local governments some marijuana revenue sharing capabilities.
I think what the governor is looking for is not something novel. We see this in every other state. Local governments do usually get a share of the revenue, considering that they have to provide the roads, security, the fire, all the things that are required to do businesses or to oversee businesses of this type.
State Senator Trey Pardee, the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 75, expressed strong disapproval over the governor's vetoing of the bill, arguing he had previously made a deal with Governor Matt Meyer that if he allowed the bill to become law, Democratic senators would signal their support for some capability of county revenue sharing. But Senator Pardee told Delaware Public Media he was in favor of a smaller percentage of the revenue, around 2 to 3%, versus Governor Meyer's proposal of 4.5%. The veto has put a wedge between Democratic senators and the governor, and with an attempt to override the veto not out of the question, there's uncertainty around if the legislature would now even consider allowing the counties to have a piece of the pie.
I think the governor's goal is to strike a balance between the two, you know, to say, hey, you know, let's give you a stake in the industry, so that way you have a reason to not fight against it, which is what we're seeing, but to actually help us facilitate the growth of the industry. And my hope is that the, you know, the legislature and the governor can get on the same page and, you know, find a way to really thread this needle, which is a difficult one.
While the fate of Senate Bill 75 and a county revenue sharing bill remain up in the air, Sanderlin says it is possible for Sussex County license holders to transfer their license to another county if they make a case for it.
I have, in fact, permitted folks to move licenses of certain types, depending on, you know, what they're seeing, where they're proposed to go to. But yeah, you know, one of the upsides is, you know, this office does have a good bit of leeway in helping businesses get into the places they need to go and get up and running. And that's really what we're focused on. And, you know, for any licensees out there who have a conditional license or having trouble, please reach out to my office. You know, we have the ability to do variances for a wide array of issues.
Tracy Sutherland currently holds two social equity licenses for a testing facility in Newcastle and Sussex County. Testing facilities aren't facing the same zoning restrictions as retail, but she says she's looking into transferring one of her licenses because she's been struggling to find investors. Tracy says she's found a real estate investor in Kent County who would be interested in helping her open a testing facility. The state handed out two testing facility licenses per county, but Tracy argues it doesn't necessarily matter where those facilities are located throughout the state.
And I'm just like, let it be six labs in the state or five labs in the state. Like, let if it's statewide. And I said, you know, it's crazy. I would have never even thought of wanting that to be the case until I found an investor in Kent.
Finances have been a serious concern for Tracy throughout her process of trying to enter the marijuana space. She's invested a lot of personal money, and her trucking and logistics company went under just months ago. She says luckily one of the current marijuana conversion operators hired her on as a cultivation technician, but she will have to resign from that position once her testing facilities become operational to avoid a conflict of interest. She is poised to receive a grant from the state as a social equity license holder, but she's worried that still won't come close to the capital she needs to get the facility off the ground.
Until I get an investor, you know, I'm just sitting on my hands, even though the grant, I'll get $175,000. That isn't even, you know, 10% of the full amount I would need to start a lab and secure real estate.
But some license holders have found success throughout the process. Kirsten McGuigan and her husband, Andrew Kleinstuber, have faced their fair share of roadblocks in getting their microcultivation facility off the ground in Sussex County. While they have had months of back and forth with the Office of the Marijuana Commissioner in trying to obtain their conditional license, the pair officially put seeds in the ground on August 8th. Kirsten says they're looking at anywhere from 70 to 100 days until their plants are mature in flower and ready to harvest. And after the testing process, they can begin selling their cannabis to dispensaries.
That is something that we're basically in the middle of right now. As we have these plants, we didn't want to do it too prematurely. So now that we have these plants that exist and we have a pretty good idea of when it will be harvested, we are right in the middle of that process of reaching out to different dispensaries and forming connections.
Kirsten also hopes their organic soil-based growing methods will provide a niche in the market that will help them stand out against traditional hydroponically grown marijuana plants.
We are farmers ourselves of plants and animals, and we really love the idea of all the organic regenerative farming, giving back to the land, all of that, keeping things as natural as possible. So we really really want to bring that to the cannabis. So we're using the living soil, which we mix and add all of our own organic amendments and all of that for the nutrients, sort of instead of the synthetic amendments that are sometimes commonplace in the industry. So we do hope that that sets us apart, and we're excited about that. The feedback we've heard, we feels like people are excited about that as well. And I think it's sort of what people are looking for.
While some growers are up and running, Commissioner Sanderlin says it's really up to the license holders as to when the rest of the market will be open for business, largely depending upon their ability to find investors and viable real estate to reach active licensure status.
Not all businesses will be operating at the same speed. I would like to see some retail opening by the end of the year, if not sooner. But that really, falls on the businesses to, find a location, get into a lease, set up their process. Date has been working to schedule anybody who requests inspections or pre-inspections, which I think is very helpful. As a former business owner, having a pre-inspection really helps you to make sure that you know where all your problems lie, and that it makes it more of a seamless process to come online. So, as people let us know, we are, we'll be on site and scheduling as fast as they can get open.
Despite all the previous and continued hurdles in getting the market up and running, Sanderlin says he remains optimistic about what's to come.
It's a snowball rolling downhill. We're gaining speed. The first month went really well. Now it's getting everybody else online, now that they have a program they can join. One of the things I feared was giving all these active licenses and then there's no program for them to join. So now we have a program and it's functional. We're moving into a month where people are coming back into the state from vacations. So I'm hopeful for September numbers as well. And really, providing a good landing spot for all these new licensees.
Sarah Petrowich, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at how a University of Delaware assistant professor is helping develop a more effective approach to puberty education. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. Some of our most awkward childhood and teenage memories are connected to puberty. That's one reason why puberty and sex education exist, to address uncomfortable subjects head-on and give young people the language and information they need to understand their bodies. There's a lot that goes into those lesson plans, and most of the research and conversation is about what teachers can talk about in the classroom. Very little research addresses how to teach those classes. University of Delaware Assistant Professor Sarah Curtis is trying to change that. She and her team looked at different teaching approaches and how to make classes more accessible for students with disabilities. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sits down with Curtis to talk about puberty education and how it can be improved.
Can you talk a little bit about what puberty and sex education looks like in the U.S. right now?
So puberty education, and really all sex education, varies widely across the United States. Our implementation of sex education in schools has some components that are decided at the state level, other components that are decided at the district level, and then the implementation that happens even at the school level varies. So it's hard to speak to what it looks like nationally just because there is so much variation. But in general, there are sex education standards that have been agreed upon by sex education experts, which I would say are aspirational to what should be taught across schools. And in the area of puberty, they focus on really basic things like the parts of the body, the changes that are associated with puberty cognitively, physically, and emotionally.
So you touched on what we see across puberty education, like you said, anatomy changes, what folks can expect. What do we know about how to most effectively teach puberty education?
I will say in the area of sex education, a lot of the thought and planning that goes into it is in what should be taught, because the content is so sensitive. There's just a lot of stakeholder input that needs to go into selection. So that's the majority of, like, both on the research side and in practice, is not so much on the instructional methods, but the instructional content. And to kind of fill in that space, then we rely on a lot of the best practices for example, science education, health education, more generally. Or in my case, what I try to pull into my work is what we need to take from special education to make sure that sex education, puberty education is accessible as it needs to be.
Absolutely. And can you talk a little bit about what that might look like? How do you make education more accessible?
So in my work, what we have done is looked at a framework called Universal Design for Learning. It is a way of thinking about potential student challenges, be they academic or emotional, and planning for that. Those kinds of challenges. A lot of times in special education, we think about individualizing instruction for a particular student, but this is taking a more class-based approach, thinking about the kinds of individualization that often needs to occur and implementing it at a class level. So for example, you know going into any given classroom, right, that there are maybe some students who have stronger literacy skills or stronger reading skills than others. So instead of individualizing the text for the one student who might need specialized reading materials, how can we use perhaps multiple ways of presenting information to help level the playing field for all the students in the class? So we might have a text that students have maybe the choice, or we do both, like we have the option to read it yourself or read it with a partner or read it out loud.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's essentially, to me, it sounds like Universal Design for Learning is an approach to teaching, and it essentially gives students and teachers more options in the classroom. Is that right?
Also, with choice comes agency. So I think one of the things I really like about UDL is the ways in which it considers the student as a whole person, that our academic tasks also have an emotional component to them. And that's really obvious when it comes to things like puberty, right? When we're teaching puberty, like the students are embarrassed, they're excited, they're scared, but we have a structured emotional check-in before we jump into the content of the lesson. We're helping provide space to process the emotions that are connected to the content. So this both and of thinking about the academic learning needs and also the emotional learning needs helps, again, holistically for the lesson to be much more accessible.
And that actually leads me to something that I wanted to talk about, which was the awkwardness of having to talk about puberty and sex with children. I mean, how do you think that UDL accommodates for awkwardness and maybe a hesitancy to talk about something that young kids see as taboo or embarrassing?
So UDL in general provides a framework for like thinking about how you would want to address that for your own particular content area, right? Because you're working with maybe an experienced educator. When we say the word penis, like we're going to have a lot of feelings. So we know that's a challenge that we can anticipate and plan for. And all the ways that you plan for that are varied. Like it doesn't constrain you to a specific way of dealing with that and gives you a lot of tools for addressing it. What we specifically did is we provided some opportunities for more computer-driven interaction that made it so students didn't feel like they had to raise their hand or ask their questions vocally in front of the class where all their peers would know. It also gave us opportunities to like check for understanding, so where students didn't have to fill out a quiz and have it turned in, like in real time, we could see which students were missing certain concepts, and the educator could respond in real time to those misses. So that really helped reduce some of the anxiety for the students. We felt the evidence we saw is that it helped them feel more confident about what they learned.
And do you think that's because there's, from the student's perspective, less attention and anxiety spent on their interaction with the material?
I guess I think it's threefold. Less emotional distress with the content. Two, we're putting in better educational strategies, you know, academic strategies. We didn't see differences in knowledge in our study, but I think that was really because the students have so much to learn about puberty. We had this like ceiling effect. Like regardless of the way that we taught the puberty lessons, the students had really large knowledge gains. The stress that comes from like, oh, this is hard to learn, they were also experiencing an ease of that piece. And then the third piece is one of the things that's part of the UDL framework is you give students more ownership of their own monitoring of their learning.
There wasn't a difference in knowledge gained between traditional and UDL approaches, but there was a difference in confidence and competency. Is that right?
Exactly. That's what we saw in our study. So we can't teach anything different from each class. We're only again, implementing some of these like check-ins about your learning, emotional pauses, sometimes offering multiple ways to view the material, sometimes having these different kinds of ways of checking in on the instruction.
What do you think is the goal with UDL specifically? What should students walk away with?
It's not like students weren't embarrassed or weren't uncomfortable, but I think every person deserves the right to just know the basics of their body. You should know either the changes that are about to happen or currently happening to you. You have the right to know about menstruation. These are just, to me, basic. And especially for students with disabilities, they're often denied access to this basic information. Or if they are getting access to it, it's in a way that's not necessarily accessible to them. They've looked at studies and students who have IEPs receive sex education at a significantly lower rate than students who are not on IEPs. So, you know, to me, that's kind of my motivation for making sure that, you know, if this is the way that we're providing sex education, it's as accessible as possible to as many students as possible.
And just to double check, IEP, is that individual education plan?
So this is the legal document that individualizes student with disabilities education. Even walking away with like, I know that like certain parts of my body are going to get bigger. I know that I'm going to have changes in my mood. I'm going to have differences in the kinds of friends. I'm going to have to start wearing deodorant. You know, like these are things that I hope students walk away with at the end of the workshop. You know, in our traditional way of thinking about education, a lot of times we think about sexual education as an extra, not a built-in, right? And so that's kind of how we like structure it. But it's just kind of easy when you're in this kind of environment to overly rely on more didactic, more explaining, all group discussion where people have to raise their hands. That's always going to privilege the students who have the quickest processing speed and the highest comfort with speaking out loud.
I think it's so interesting that here in Delaware, you have an outside public health expert come in, because for me, I was taught by my gym teacher. And something that really sticks out here is that, you know, you're putting that emotional aspect front and center along with the educational aspect. And I think back to my gym teacher, Mr. A, who was so uncomfortable delivering the material that he was teaching us, that I remember it being difficult to learn and even more difficult to engage with. And I was a very anxious, shy kid, so the odds of me raising my hand were very low, and they went down even more because Mr. A was so uncomfortable himself. Can you talk a little bit about how you know this approach might help schools like mine, where it's not even a public health expert teaching, it's a gym teacher or a social studies teacher?
Yes, and I do want to say there are schools in Delaware, and especially like different grades, where it is the PE teacher who's teaching sex ed, or some other, sometimes it's a nurse, sometimes it's a social worker. We do not have sex education built into our teacher preparation program. And so teachers are often uncomfortable. That is definitely one of the benefits of choosing an outside expert. But there's drawbacks too. It's not like that person then, right, that expert who's coming in is going to be there every single time a student gets their period for the first time, right? And so there's all these in-situation moments that happen outside of that 1 week where those educators are in, where it's really helpful to have people who have this educational background and the comfort.
So my last question for you, what's next for you in this area? Are you going to continue studying or looking at puberty education?
So right now I'm working on a paper that is actually geared towards sex educators. I had done a study where we interviewed more people than I thought we would find. We've over 40 people who teach sex ed specifically to people with intellectual disability. So students with intellectual disability tend to need more specialized instruction. So we're going to be talking about the kinds of specialized instruction that those students need, particularly from the voice of the actual educators. And I do put any like curriculum I find or resources I find for teaching sex education specifically to people with disabilities on my website. That's asdsexed.org. It's a lot autism focused, but it's also just focused on disability across the board.
Thanks to University of Delaware Assistant Professor Sarah Curtis and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at the work Reading Assist is doing in the First State. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Reading Assist is among 15 organizations from around the world recently recognized by the Library of Congress for their efforts to improve literacy and strengthen the communities they serve. This week, Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari sits down with Reading Assist CEO Caroline O'Neill to learn more about why the organization was honored and its ongoing work in the community, including how it's navigating the recent ups and downs of federal funding.
Reading Assist received the 2025 Library of Congress Literacy Award. And what is this award and what does it mean for Reading Assist?
No, thank you. The Library of Congress Literacy Award is awarded to 24 organizations working to expand literacy and promote reading in the United States and abroad. It's a fantastic award that recognizes honorees' practices to implement successful practices in literacy programming. Each one of the honorees, including ourselves, we get a $10,000 award, but we're really just honored to be recognized for the impact and the result that our fellows and students are achieving every year.
Are there some specific things that you guys are doing that were cited for winning this award?
Yeah, so they were really looking at the impact we're having in implementing evidence-based practices to promote literacy, particularly with struggling readers in kindergarten through third grade. So they recognized the commitment to evidence-based practices, both with high-quality, high-impact tutoring and using a structured literacy science of reading aligned curriculum to bring increased literacy to students who are struggling.
So how does Reading Assist measure your own success? What are some success stories?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for asking. We are deeply committed to results of our students. Oftentimes, we measure as nonprofits, we talk a lot about output, the amount of hours we spend tutoring and training and supporting those whom we serve. But at our organization, we measure first and foremost how many of our students are learning to read. We are deeply committed to getting outcomes for our students and measure that with rigor. We're a data-driven organization that uses data both internally and externally to measure our success. One of the ways in which we do this is we use a nationally known exam to look at student progress on a weekly basis and an annual basis. We look at our students every single week, see what kind of progress they're making to make sure that we're providing them a really personalized and customized learning program so that they can thrive. And it's incredible. 90% of our students reach benchmarks in foundational reading skills in just 1 year. And we look at our early learners, our kindergarten students, we see that almost 85% of those students are reading on grade level after having a Reading Assist tutor in a year. And listen, I got to tell you, Joe, the students that we work with oftentimes are significantly behind. Students that are really struggling to read and struggling in their reading confidence. We've had third graders who are still struggling to spell their own name. But at the end of the year, those third graders have unlocked it, are excited about learning to read, are asking for a library card. They're engaging and feeling confident about reading, even though they may have started the year not feeling confident. I love to tell the story of, Gary, one of our tutors in Dover. He'll say, it's tough at the beginning of the year. We're working with kids that often know that they're behind. They feel it. You know, a first grader that's not reading, they're feeling that frustration. They don't know why it's harder for them. And so they're sometimes resistant to having a tutor. They're not feeling confident in their reading. And so he said, at the beginning of the year, my tutor, he wouldn't even look at me, wouldn't make eye contact with me. And at the end of the year, the tutors and the student bond is so incredible. The students have confidence. The teacher said, this kid is the best reader in the class. This kid is the one that has his hand up first. To go from not even able to make contact, feeling low confidence, to being the first one to volunteer to read aloud in a classroom. We see that story across the nearly 2,000 students we worked with, or more 2,000 students we worked with this past school year. It's just incredible to see those kinds of results for kids.
You just mentioned the student side. What about the importance of your work on initiatives on the educator side? For instance, the Tutors to Teachers program to help address the literacy issue.
Oh, we are so proud of Tutors to Teachers and our really incredible partner, Wilmington University. They've been excellent in helping us really create a pathway, an educator pathway that recognizes the work that our tutors and teachers put into the classroom or into their tutoring year so that they are able to become confident educators. We started to notice years ago that many of our tutors, after they finished, they would get a job with the schools. The schools were so impressed with the dedication, the commitment, as well as the quality of the training that they receive in literacy, and that they would start to, they would get hired by the schools and become classroom teachers. And so we, you know, had a conversation with Wilmington University about how about we are more intentional. If we know folks are using tutoring as a chance to explore the possibility of a career in education, what if we make that structured and support them so that they can have a clear facilitated classroom pathway into a classroom without any shortcut? So what we've created then is a really a dual program. Tutors are able to dual enroll with Reading Assist, being taking on a tutoring fellowship year, and with Wilm University. They are cohorted, which means they get to learn together. It's a scaffolded program, so they're taking one course at a time, maintaining an appropriate sort of course load while working with students. They earn a stipend with us in the first year, and then in their second year, they become residence teachers. Again, building up their teacher toolkit so that they feel they are confident educators at the end of their residency year. And the great thing about this program is because of the AmeriCorps funding that they get, the education award, the recognition of the articulation agreement that Reading Assist has with WilmU, there's a really minimal cost. I think it's something around $4,000 at most that these folks have to pay for a master's in special education. So they're able to earn a master's in special education, get classroom certified, all while earning a stipend and all while staying committed and working in schools.
How critical has your work been to help recover from the pandemic learning loss?
We were struggling as a state and as a nation with literacy before the pandemic, and it only exacerbated it. We know that particularly for those most vulnerable students, those students who did not have access to a strong virtual learning environment at home. So it's been really critical for us to be able to come in and support those students who are most vulnerable and most at risk. We worked with a lot of kindergarten through third grade students, but we have expanded our support to fourth, fifth, and even sixth grade students, students who are still disproportionately affected by the pandemic so that we can get them where they need to be and get them back on track. Look, there's two things that we know from research and evidence work incredibly well. One of them is high quality, high impact tutoring. So there's specific research around what defines high quality impact tutoring. It's things like minimum of 90 minutes a week, small group sizes, no more than four. The tutors have to have high quality curriculum and instructional materials that they use, and those tutors should be coached and supported throughout their tutoring experience. We follow all of the guidelines of high quality, high impact tutoring. And we know that there's strong evidence that shows that if students are exposed to high quality, high impact tutoring, they're going to thrive and we're going to be able to close opportunity and achievement gaps. The other thing that research tells us works is a structured literacy program. We know that 95% of students can learn how to read by the end of first grade, I'm not saying third grade, I'm saying first grade, with high quality instruction, with access to a structured literacy program. Reading Assist is an accredited structured literacy training program. So we combine the evidence around, we like to call the science of reading, with the evidence around high quality, high impact tutoring, which means that we're able to give students it not just what we have to give, but exactly what they need to be able to grow and thrive.
What do you specifically see here in Delaware, where student testing shows ELA proficiency remains stubbornly low, especially in high need schools, especially with Governor Meyer declaring a literacy emergency?
So I'll tell you something that gives me hope. You know, obviously we look at the NAEP scores and they're not scores to be proud of. We're not proud of them yet. But we know that the Delaware has been really thoughtful over the past few years, trying to learn from other states that have had success and start to implement practices, policies, and supports that are going to help us grow in literacy. And so while certainly looking at the NAEP scores, there's still a level of disappointment, there's a couple of bright spots to me that give me hope that we're on the right direction. And the first one is that looks like 2013 until 2022, we were on a downward path in terms of our NAEP scores. This year, this 2024, is the first year in many that we've actually gone up, which tells me we know that it is a journey to be able to become, to create a strong literate community. And when we look at other states that have success, we knew it didn't happen overnight. It took years of implementing strong practices, not just in the intervention space or the tutoring space, but in the whole classroom as well. And so it feels like the beginning of that turnaround to me when I look at those scores. That gives me hope. And the other thing, you know, we work in a space of specifically with students who are economically disadvantaged. We work with students who are more vulnerable. And so when I look at the subscores of our NAEP report from this year, we also saw very modest increases there in the percentage of students at or above NAEP under the economically disadvantaged status. Both basic and proficient rates went up. So while there's not something, these aren't scores that we should be incredibly excited or proud about, I am seeing a glimmer of hope that we're on the right path and on the right direction here.
How did the federal funding cuts to AmeriCorps hurt you guys last year? And the recent restoration of those funds, have they put you guys back on track?
Okay, we are back on track, and we are so deeply grateful for our supporters, for folks that got real vocal about the impact that AmeriCorps has had on communities. You know, our congressional delegates in Delaware were wonderful in terms of being vocal in support, being responsive, as well as Governor Meyer and his team. So a lot of gratitude there. It worked. We are back on track. I will say we are well funded with AmeriCorps funding for next year. That is making us hopeful. We've been able to add partners this year in Delaware and beyond because of that restored AmeriCorps funding. We remain hesitantly cautious about the future. While next year looks secure, we are always mindful that we need to continue to partner and be creative with our schools to make sure that we're providing and creating sustainable supports for schools.
Thanks to Reading Assist CEO Caroline O'Neill and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Arts Playlist, where we learn more about the shows closing out the season for Clear Space Theater in Rehoboth Beach. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. After a busy summer season featuring three blockbuster musicals and a cabaret series, performers from the Clear Space Theater Company in Rehoboth Beach will be back on the boards in 1 week, launching a series of shows to round out the year, beginning with the apolitical political farce, POTUS. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny sits down with Clear Space Managing Director Joe Fowler to talk about that show and the rest of the 2025 season.
I want to start with POTUS, which opens next Friday, September 18th. The play has a really great provocative kind of subtitle, which I'll call on you to share, and then talk a little bit about what this play is about.
Am I allowed to say the full subtitle on public radio?
I think you are, yes.
All right. I just wanted to ask. The play is called POTUS. Where behind every great dumbass are seven women trying to keep him alive. It is an incredibly funny farce in the spirit of all sort of the great theatrical farces from all time. It is pointed, it is hilarious, and it is entirely apolitical. So the premise of the play is that an unspecified fictional president has used an inappropriate four-letter word to describe his wife. And from that moment, amazing PR debacle unfolds. What's beautiful about the play is that you never actually see the president on stage in the play. All of the characters in the play are the seven women in his life who are trying to resolve this issue. And in the course of resolving the issue, you can only imagine how many strange and unexpected comedic moments might unfold. But you've got his chief of staff. You've got his press secretary, his actual secretary, his sister, a journalist who covers him, his wife, and the woman who is not his wife, but is in his life. And at various points in the play, what Sarah Fillinger, who wrote this piece, has done so beautifully is, you know, if you wanted to try to guess who the president is, at various points in the play, the president could be potentially any president that sat in the Oval Office over the last 40 or 50 years. It is 100% not about a particular person, and it's crafted in a way to make clear we don't know the party affiliation of the president. So that's, I think, what's the beauty of the piece. You can come and laugh and have a great time in the way that you would if there was this wild mashup of The Office and West Wing or something like that on stage. I think people are going to have an incredible experience. The production has sold out, but we've added a performance on Sunday, September the 21st at 7 p.m. because sales have been so robust. So we're excited to be able to have more seats available, so more people who have yet to discover the play will have a chance to join us here in Rehoboth Beach for it.
And it seems to me just kind of so refreshing, because so much about politics today is very serious, very grave, very somber. We can make fun of politics too.
The White House is a workplace like any other workplace. And just like the Mary Tyler Moore Show helped to make fun of one kind of workplace, and The Office made fun of another, and Scrubs made fun of another, right? You can appreciate the hard work that it is to be in any of these roles at the White House, but you can also sort of pause to reflect on the fact that it's all right to stop and laugh too, because I'm sure there are countless moments in presidential history that we don't know about, that were hilarious, but those aren't the things we focus on. So this is entirely fictional, but it is very much grounded in the truth of what it means to be put in a pressure cooker and to try to solve a very hard problem when the personalities at play may not always be perfectly suited to solve that problem. And I think that's sometimes the source for great situational comedy, because it's the situation that's funny, and it's the people who are put in the situation and how they try to solve for that situation that keep us wanting to watch and find out what's going to happen next.
So coming up in October is, I'm going to call it a classic, but a camp classic, re-envisioned as a musical, Reefer Madness. This is going to be fantastic, I think.
Yes, so Reefer Madness, people might be familiar with as a stage musical or as the film adaptation of the stage musical, but it's kind of been a cult classic in the way that Rocky Horror is a cult classic. You know, it's this sort of B-movie, underground sort of a stage experience. People might end up shouting back at the show once or twice, and if they do, that's okay, because it's that kind of a fun, irreverent vibe and energy that the show is going for. It's adapted, though, from a real documentary that was made in 1936 that was meant to be a cautionary tale to warn parents and children to the dangers of Mary Jane and jazz and their corrupting influence in American society. And you flash forward almost 90 years later, and it's easy to see how it would be quite possible to take a look at that very well-intentioned message from 1936 and perhaps poke some fun at that message. What's kind of remarkable about the stage musical is there are sections that are verbatim taken from that 1936 documentary. And when you hear them today, you can't help but laugh, because the dangers of everything are so wildly overstated that it almost already feels like a parody of itself. And so we always try to pick a show in October that is fun, that's irreverent, that maybe sort of ties into the spooky season of Halloween. I don't want to give anything away, but I will say that, you know, that there are some demons that appear in this show and some unexpected turns that definitely fit the Halloween season. But it's wildly irreverent. It's a chance to have a great time. You know, between POTUS and Reefer Madness, it's wonderful to sort of have this fall of great laughter, this fall where we can have some satire and humor on stage, because I do think that given, you know, given everything we're dealing with collectively in the world right now, there is huge value in pausing sometimes and to just enjoy what it means to laugh. We deserve that in balance to anything else that might be challenging in the world, and we're trying to deliver that to our audiences this September and October on stage.
Well, coming up in November, from cult classic to just classic is Annie. And I think we all kind of know the story of Annie, but this is also the spotlight on young performers. And I'd like to ask you about that specifically.
Sure. So our Spotlight on Young Performers program is one of the many programs that are part of Clear Spaces Arts Institute. And our Arts Institute is a critical part of our mission and has been since we were founded 21 years ago. The Institute is focused on creating opportunities for young people and for the community at large to be able to meaningfully learn all of the aspects of live performance. What's unique about our Spotlight program is that's one of our only audition-only programs, and that's to help those young people who have incredible potential for wonderful futures in the performing arts to be able to train and rehearse and prepare a production just as a professional team of artists might. So the program runs for the entirety of the fall, and every year, every semester, the Spotlight program culminates with a full production that's fully staged, costumed, lit, with scenic design that any other production on our stage would normally receive. So those young people have the opportunity to experience what it's like to be in a professional production, except they are performing with other artists of their age. So a piece like Annie is great because it's got opportunities for talented young performers who might be, you know, still in elementary school, as well as for talented young performers, you know, who may be teens. And it's an incredible opportunity to for those young people to get that level of training. And it's a great way for our community to celebrate the potential that is in our region right now through these very talented folks.
Well, finally, opening in late November and kind of rounding out 2025 for Clear Space Theater is A Christmas Carol, a super traditional classic. It's been done so many ways over the years. There's the Alistair Sims, Patrick Stewart, George C. Scott's Muppet Christmas Carol, a highly underrated interpretation of it. Tell me about the version that Clear Space is doing.
Absolutely. So the production that we are doing of A Christmas Carol is the version that was adapted by Alan Menken, who is a beloved Broadway and Disney animated film composer. So it really, it captures the essence, I think, of Dickens's original novel with great care and with love. But it brings kind of buoyancy and joy that you would see in Alan Menken's other work. He did Beauty and the Beast. He did Little Shop of Horrors. There's a lot of great projects that he was on over the course of his career. And I think when you see this production, you'll get that sort of feel of a warm family classic that's being lovingly recreated with sort of a sensibility that is more in line with sort of those sort of classic show tunes, but still very much maintaining the kind of heart that you would experience, you know, in any of the classic Disney animated films that Alan Menken composed. So I think it's going to be a very joyful way to celebrate the holidays. And with Annie, those two productions combined between November and December are really about celebrating family and connection. And in a way, as you look at the rhythm of our season, it's a lovely balance, you know, to some of the more irreverent satire that's filling the earlier part of the fall.
Thanks to Joe Faller, Managing Director of the Clear Space Theater Company, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. You can learn more about Clear Space Theater's 2025 season, including performance dates and ticket information, at clearspacetheater.org. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Erzeri, Abigail Lee, Martin Matheny, and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.